Hello there, and I'm Sheila Grace Harvey, and welcome to Relationship Revelations. Today, I'm very happy to have a guest with me called Paul Hunting, and I'd just like to give you a little bit of information about him. He graduated from Bristol University in the UK with honours in psychology. He spent 10 years in advertising agencies, including Saatchi & Saatchi and Young & Rubicam. He then gave up a successful career to pioneer transformational coaching in companies, and in 1993, he was inspired to create the field of transformational horsemanship. He's taken well over 1,000 clients through his unique process, and he's also been a devoted student of soul transcendence, meditation, and horsemanship for over 25 years. He has a book out called Why Talk to a Guru When You Can Whisper to a Horse, which is the most fabulous title. Welcome, Paul Hunting.
Thank you very much.
I believe it's very early where you are.
I believe it is as well. I'm not really sure. It's very dark.
I do think that...
I'm sure I'm going to cut as this proceeds.
Oh, I'll be gentle then with the questions for
you.
I was just going to say it's a wonderful technology when you consider that the radio station BBS Radio is in California, you're in England, and I'm calling from New Zealand, so I think it's amazing what we can do these days.
Yeah, science fiction, isn't it?
It is, really. Mm. Now, Paul, one of the things that, looking at your life now, I thought you had three horses, but you said something to me the other day, and I think that's now incorrect. You've got the three horses, Maddie, Serendipity, and Ollie. Now, do I understand there's some additions?
There are. We have babies this year. We've got two little additions called, one's called Charisma.
Charisma.
With a K. She's a little filly. And the other one's called Boris.
Boris.
Yes, Boris. Well, it's short for Baruch Beshan.
Oh, right. Well, I haven't actually finished the show with that, so that's the blessings already are.
Yes, indeed. So that's his name, so... But we call him Boris for short.
Boris for short.
He seems to prefer that. Certainly at this tender age, they're now 4 months old, I think.
Oh, well, that's lovely. Mm. So, Paul, you know, if you look at your life right now and with your horses, and I guess really in many respects from knowing you over the years, it's really been your dream to have a beautiful place there, which is in the Cotswolds, the horses, and a business that is really assisting people in transforming their lives. But it's taken quite a bit for you to get there. So I'd like to kind of go back to your in the early 90s. You were in a coaching business. A recession hit.
That's right, yes.
Your business was over. You retreated to the Cotswolds. Tell us a little bit about how you kind of went from more of the working coaching just into companies into working with horses.
Well, horses had always been my passion and my recreation, my recreation. And in the 90s, I got very badly hit, very suddenly, in the recession. It was almost an overnight thing. And I wasn't really prepared for it, so it was quite a shock when suddenly there was I had no clients because they had no money and... I had no money to spend on the kind of stuff I was doing. So I was suddenly out of business, really. Obviously I had a lot of, I was very heavily committed to, you know, the financial outgoing side of things. With nothing to come in, it was very difficult, very painful. So I managed to liquidate as much as I could. And retreated. I sort of went to live in the Cotswolds with my partner at the time. It was R&R in a way. I just wanted to rest and recuperate and sort of get myself together and regenerate. I decided I'd not been involved with horses or riding for several years at this point because I'd been living in London, and it just wasn't very easy, and it wasn't really my priority then either.
No.
So I took up riding again.
Oh, great!
purely for, I had no ulterior motive whatsoever. And I found this wonderful teacher, and she had some amazing horses. And I used to go there. It was quite a long drive from here, but I used to go there quite regularly. I shall never forget this day. I went along for what I thought was going to be just a regular riding lesson. And she put me on my favorite horse, who was a really big 17-hand Irish gelding called Spud. And I don't know, he must have been in a strange kind of mood this day, because somehow, whatever I did, he just didn't want to play. And I was up there, and he just wanted to dance. And I found that the more I attempted to use force to control him, to try and bend into my will, as it were, and actually make myself feel safe, because that's the last thing I was feeling at this point, the worse it got. The more excited he got, the stronger he got. And he was bouncing me around and practically pulling me over the top of his head. He was so incredibly strong. And I started to realize that I was in very real danger. He wouldn't stop, and he wouldn't go where I wanted. And it was a main road was looming nearby, and he seemed to be heading towards it. And I really thought that I was either going to be killed or seriously injured, and I was absolutely terrified. And then something happened, and I can't really... I've sort of reverse-engineered it. I've looked at it, with hindsight, to say, well, what was it that actually took place? But the result was that I changed something inside myself. I went from resistance to cooperation and what I now call leadership, instead of attempting to control him. I tuned in with him and started to direct him and develop a rapport with him. And suddenly two things changed, transformed. One was the way he was going, from a crazy young buckaroo, he transformed into an almost perfectly rounded dressage horse. And my teacher was just completely dumbfounded. I mean, she was standing there the whole time, feeling very helpless, because there's nothing she could really do. I mean, and she was absolutely amazed at the way he started going. And she said, "Wow, you could go around badminton like that." I'll never forget those words. But it wasn't just the external result. It was what was going on for me internally that was so remarkable. I was basically having a spiritual convergence. It was a convergent moment. I just felt completely connected to the horse, and through him to the earth and the planet, and then through a sort of a higher level of consciousness through to the high self, the spirit, whatever you want to call it, the light. And I could actually see these things and feel these energies in a way that I'd never experienced before. It was a transformational moment for me. And when I finally stopped, I don't know how long I was with him in this state, but I was reviewing it with her in the pub. We went for a pie and a pint afterwards. And I thought, oh my God, if only I could bring this kind of experience to my clients. Not the life-threatening bit, but the the awakening bit. I didn't think putting my clients in a situation where they had a fair chance of being killed or seriously injured was a particularly good business model. But
not a good business model.
No. The other bit, if I could just...
You lose a lot of them very fast.
I thought, wow, I'd really have something. And that became my quest. How can I bring this experience to my clients and keep them safe throughout the whole thing?
Right.
And that was the initial intention, and that was, I guess, now about 15 years ago.
Right.
And it was. I call it an intention because it must have been because. That's what I'm doing now, and it even despite wanting to give up and feeling defeated and you know, running into huge logistical and financial difficulties attempting to manifest this, nevertheless, you know, here it is, here I am, and here we are. It was a remarkable experience for me.
So from having that clear intention through to now having the model that you work with people, how did you get from one to the other? Because the thing, obviously, for a lot of us, when we're looking at creating something, we have a clear intention, and without that, you really don't have anything. And I know that's something that I often used to hear you talking about, clear intention, clear intention. So you need the clear intention to begin with, but sometimes to get to where you're going, there is still a lot of different stages. What were just, you know, a couple of the stages that took you from that to where you had a model that worked for you?
Well, one of the turning points was, it's hard to pick it out. You know, where did it start? Everything runs into each other. But I can remember there was a point where I'd managed to get some publicity for the work that I was doing, and I had a series of articles in the one of the horse magazines in the UK. The thing that I wanted to happen actually happened, which was that I would actually connect with somebody in human resources or in business at a senior level that also was involved with horses and would be reading this article with their riding hat rather than their corporate hat on, but then see the connection, and that's exactly what happened. And this person, to cut a long story short, engaged me to do a major project with her company where she wanted to put over 100 people through a program using the horses. Of course, I said, yes, I'd do it, but I had no idea how I would actually deliver the work because it was far too much work for one person. I was the only person that actually, as far as I knew, that was doing this kind of work anywhere. I didn't have a resource bank. So I was put in a situation where I really had to train people to do what I was doing, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I mean, I did it, but I was, you know, I was winging it. I'd get out there, and I knew that if I kept going, I'd find some keys and be able to facilitate some kind of awareness and transformation in my clients, and that's what I did. But that's about it.
So basically, it was a kind of a bit of trial and error, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of trial and, yes, and a lot of error, indeed. So when it came to training people up, you know, in a short space of time in what I was doing, I had to figure it out. I had to sort of chunk it down and say, well, I do this, and I do this, and I do that. And through doing that kind of analysis, I figured out that I actually had a very powerful model. Actually, something I don't know if you've read the book, but it's something that is a very powerful relationship model and leadership model. And I call it the True Solution because that's the acronym. It's the acronym stands for trust, respect, understanding, and energy. And the if you like, the idea is that the quality and the depth of energy in any relationship is directly proportional to the degree of trust, respect, and understanding. That says the word true, and I thought, wow, that's isn't that cool? And that came out of working actually directly with a horse one day. I was working with Maddie, and we were out in a pretty large space, and she was cantering around me in a circle, and completely at liberty. She wasn't constrained by anything at all. She was cantering around me, and then I asked her to. I don't know if you know what a flying change is.
No, I don't.
But it's when a horse changes direction and changes leads in the transition. And I asked her to do this, and she did it. It was quite a miraculous thing. For me, it was absolutely remarkable. And she was just playing with me. She was completely connected, and we were just playing and dancing, and it was just the most joy-filled kind of experience. And I was thinking about it afterwards. I think, why would she do this? Why would this horse do this with me? I mean, okay, she must understand what I'm asking her to do, but there has to be more than just the understanding. I mean, why would she do it? I mean, she could understand what I'm asking her and still go off and do something else, which is what horses are notorious for. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't follow people around necessarily. They're not like dogs. They're prey animals, and they're hardwired to resist and to fight or flee from predators, mm-hmm. which is what we are.
Yeah.
So why would she give up her instincts to do this and hang out with me like this? And I figured there must have been a large element of trust, and then respect, as well as the understanding. There was a sort of a composite there. There was there was something else going on. I thought, yeah, well, that's actually the basis of the model. Those three elements in any relationship you've got that's not working or you want to enhance, you can seek for one of those or a combination of those elements that are weak or are blocked, and that's really the way in, and that's really the keystones of the work that I do is finding out where the blockage is, where the energy is blocked, and bringing awareness and bringing energy back into that situation and clearing it. And the horse becomes, in this situation, a mirror for the human. This is the cool thing. It's like, the problem we have as human beings, and it's probably the single problem that we have is the ego, the false self, and the illusions that it spins and the games it likes to play. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it's a difficult thing to deal with. It just gets in the way. It's got its own agenda. It's almost like an independent being. And when we relate to each other, human to human, the ego is always there, and it's always alive. It's always a factor. But when you relate to a horse, the horse doesn't have an ego. It doesn't have that kind of pattern. Doesn't have that false self hardwired in with the dynamics of the false self. You know, which is the duality. You know, the right and wrong, and the need to prove things. The need for recognition and all the other sacred cows that we worship. Horse just doesn't have that. So when we get in a situation with a horse where you can't use force or restraint to achieve a result. It completely thwarts the strategy of the ego. And you're left with who you are. And the way we work with people is to facilitate them moving into the true self, their authentic self. And the horse just changes its behavior when we do that. It starts to follow. It starts to treat us as a leader. It wants to be with us. It's more than happy, if it can, if it understands what we want, to do what we're asking. And that has become the model of leadership that I use for my clients as well, because you know it has been necessary, but I think we're going through a definite crisis at the moment in of leadership in the world. I mean, just from an environmental perspective, you know, the need for sustainable business and the kind of leadership that goes with that is itself sustainable. I don't think it's ever been more important. We're just not getting away with it anymore. We're not getting away with not doing that anymore. The grains of sand are running out.
And you actually do mention a few things that are really very, very relevant in your book. In terms of, you talk a bit about the companies and what they do. I think that a lot of what I was reading when I was reading through the book, I was thinking, gosh, it is so relevant to today, because even you're talking about being in a recession and suddenly you had no business. I mean, that's very relevant to a lot of people. People are going to find that their situation is changing, and what you did was, in fact, found something else and ended up with an opportunity that created something that you really love doing. And I wonder how many other people will be able to find that for themselves, because so many people do what they think they need to do to make money, to have a standard of living, rather than doing something that will really make them really happy. There's something here that I just wanted to quote from...
Oh, my gosh. I'm not going to remember this. I do happen to have a copy of the book.
I have no idea what page.
Give me the page reference.
I haven't got it, but you won't need it. Okay. You say, when the majority of the leadership of an organization has the intention of living in its spiritual intelligence, then cultural intelligence starts to show up. The price, of course, is a continuous questioning of invisible, unconscious assumptions about our purpose and the goals, aims, and drivers of our enterprise. Not entirely a bad thing. If you were running a business, do you have to be number one at any price? Or would you be okay with not having to be number one, less money, a smaller market share, but a healthier, happier organization, including yourself? What are your true values? And it's lovely that you put that in there, because I think that's maybe what a lot of people are going to be looking at, and that is the having a quality and living to their true values, rather than what I think so many of us grew up with, which is where we get a lot of our control and our drive from, is feeling we have to have a certain level of success that it's out, you know, that the world sort of kind of reflects back to us is what we should be doing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Did I really say that? It's not quite good.
The end bit was me.
No, you can have it. You can have it.
Well, I like that.
Yeah, I mean, it just takes such a lot of courage to let go of the norms and mm-hmm. come into that place where we truly do trust and respect ourselves. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's trusting that if we do follow our heart, then that's going to lead us to abundance and prosperity. I mean, organizations are say the least driven by, depending on the philosophy of the organization, but I mean, to a large extent, they're driven by shareholders' demands and their duty to their shareholders. which is largely to produce profit and produce money, which is a fear-driven, it's a fear-driven strategy in the first place, but B, the whole cultural and social context is also fear-driven, anxiety-driven. So it's everybody's, I won't say responsibility, it's everybody's opportunity when things start to break down, which they will do. If they're not sustainable, they won't be sustainable. And this is what happens when people pursue strategies that are motivated by things that are unsustainable, that they collapse. It's the old, the old parable about the wise man who builds his house on the rock versus the foolish man that builds his house on the sand. When the wind and the rain comes, if you've built your business on something that's false, unreliable, that's a fantasy, it's just going to collapse in these times. And the people that have built theirs on something that's true and that is sustainable, they're the ones that are going to survive and thrive and make it through.
One of the things.
And I don't think there's a huge. The thing is. And that's the key to this kind of transformation, that the shift is actually very, very subtle. You don't have to give up everything. It's often a very, very subtle shift in attitude and in approach. It can't be defined. You can't define authenticity or truth or true leadership. Because it's a quality of energy, it's a quality of being. But it is on the one hand completely and utterly undefinable or indefinable and intangible. But on the other hand, when you touch into it, it's palpable. It is tangible. It's far more real, and you know it when you've got it, and everything changes around it.
I'm just going to give you another little quote from your book here, which I really like. It says, when I coach someone, I give them the equine litmus test. First of all, are their goals leading them towards or away from the destiny that's written inside them? I can't tell. They can't tell. But horses tell. Organizations and people who are drawn to work with us and the horses are not afraid to challenge their deeply held foundations. Much of our work is to undermine those structures that are weak, about to, or in the process of falling, which is a little bit about what you were just saying. And I loved the way you said, are their goals leading them towards or away from the destiny that's written inside them? Because it's what you're saying, it's about following the heart, not the head, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so easy to pursue things that are ego-driven, that... we all have things in our past where we've been hurt or disappointed or let down, betrayed, all of that kind of stuff. It's we carry that around with us and we feel unworthy or useless or one of those variations on that theme, and it can be very subtle, it can be very deep, and then we can set our lives up to prove that we're okay. Our whole life purpose can be driven by this doubt that we are okay, and I'm going to prove to myself and to the world that I'm a good person. And the point is, everybody is okay, everybody is a good person in truth. So the attempt to prove that by some kind of, financial means or by gaining recognition or
what's that? Okay. We're just going to go on a break for a couple of minutes and we'll be right back with Paul Hunting. Thank you. Okay, welcome back, and this is Sheila Grace Harvey and Relationship Revelations talking to Paul Hunting, and we're talking to about his book, Why Talk to a Guru When You Can Whisper to a Horse. Now, Paul, what I would like to do is I would like to talk to you, or you to talk us through, really what happens when you work with a client. I've actually got an article here by Caitlin Collins, who has worked with you, so I'm going to give a couple of little things and quotes from her and get you to take us through it. She says, horses are extremely sensitive to human incongruence or hypocrisy. They don't like it, and they will tell us so. They have an extraordinary capacity to respond purely to others' intentions. Now, what she identified was one of her issues that she was coming with. Like many self-employed people, she said she was putting a lot of effort into her business for too little return. And one of the things that you did was assign her a task to act as a metaphor for her issue. And so what she was asked to do was to lead Maddie away from the other horses and into the round pen. So could you just tell us a little bit about how you would have actually got to that point with her, and then what happens after that, and how you work with somebody when they're working with the horse?
So you want me to talk specifically about the process
like
I use with Kate, just generally about how I kind of lead people into it?
That would be great.
Yeah, specifically with Kate.
Well, Caitlin, yes, can be that one, or if you want to talk about someone else, that's fine.
Okay, well, I'll tell you how it works, and I'll see if I can remember the because I've worked with so many people, it's hard to remember all the specific details. I do remember what happened with Kate. It was an unusual situation, but basically, I'll talk to the client, and I have this thing that I call I feel a horse coming on. So I work with a client to have them discuss or explore what their what the issue is that they want to be working with, and what the outcome is that they really want with this issue. And they don't have to be at this point. They don't have to be particularly clear, because as you know, clarity shows up on the way. And our whole philosophy is that. You let the horse do it. You let the horse do the work. And if somebody isn't clear, there can be a lot of learning available in the lack of clarity. Because in a sense, you want, in the first stage of the work, you want to be exploring why somebody isn't clear. You know, what their assumptions are, what their expectations are, what their strategies are that actually perpetually will shoot themselves in the foot with. So that's all great material. But all I need at this point is just a sense of how the horse, or an exercise with the horse, will reflect back to them. On the one hand, what it will be like for them when they have their outcome, when they've worked through the issue, and on the other, you know, how they can actually work it through with the horse then and there. Because the remarkable thing is that although the horse is a metaphor, when you actually work something through with the horse, you're working it through with yourself. And you're working it through inside you, at a very, very deep, very often at a very, very deep and unconscious level. It's quite remarkable. So I guess this, yes, I remember with Kate, we were talking, and because she was already quite experienced with horses, I actually set her a very difficult challenge, and it just emerged spontaneously out of the situation we found ourselves in, because we were up at one end of the yard with all the horses, and I wanted to be working with her in the round pen, which is right at the other end of the yard. So I said, okay, well, if you can lead your chosen horse, which I think she said was Maddie, away from the rest of the herd, which is always going to be difficult, into the round pen. And that became, achieving that outcome became her metaphor. That was the goal that she started to work with. And having said that, we just moved on from there.
Yeah, she. I'll just read what she actually says here. After she had tried everything that she knew how to do to get the horse to oblige, she said, "There's no getting around the uncomfortable observation that first I tried to entice, then I tried to bully, and finally I forced Maddie to do what I wanted. This leads to the equally uncomfortable question, is this how I normally treat other people?" Yes, and one of the things she also said that you reminded her that the task was what was important, not important, it was the learning. Because I guess most of us are brought up to be so goal-orientated that we want to get it we just want to get the result. And I would imagine that with a lot of corporations that you work with, especially with a lot of people who are leaders, that there is a lot of control in the way that most people do things. So when they come against the horses... Well, we all have to learn as well as we're doing it, and that's one of the things that you find, isn't it? You still have to be authentically you. Otherwise, if you go into any of that or into judgment or whatever, then, you're in the same situation with the horses, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the paradox. I mean, people, the belief is that they're getting the results they get through control, and but that's not what's producing the result. So when people let go of control and substitute control for true communication and honesty and clarity and relationship, they get results that would have been impossible for them to control. They're so much greater. I mean, this is the thing. We're so afraid of letting go of control because of our programming and because of the... because we're driven by the ego. But when we do, the results we get are absolutely impossible, to the mind. I mean, you wouldn't set these goals. I mean, that's the thing. You let go of the kind of the itsy-bitsy, rinky-dink little goals that even though they could be quite large, that they're still small in comparison to what can show up, but you have to sacrifice the control, and that's what takes the courage. Far bigger result shows up.
Yeah.
The stuff people end up doing with the horses, they literally can hardly believe themselves because they move from something that was absolutely impossible for them to something that is. Beyond control and quite awesome, and that becomes the metaphor. And this is what I say to people: is what, given that you can see that the power that you can harness, if you surrender control, what are you going to do? What is your vision of possibility from this perspective? Rather than your vision that you had from the other perspective, and that's really the transformation, and that's what we see all the time is people move into a very different relationship with themselves, their people, and their goals and their sense of possibility, and it's constantly challenging me to do the same thing. I mean, we're in a situation now where, this credit crunch, You know, it's people having a lot of hardship, and it's hit me as well over the last week. Clients that I've been seeing on a regular basis that I've come to rely on, turning around and saying, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to put things off for a few months because we've got no funding." So, this is a deja vu situation for me.
We seem to come in cycles like that, do you think?
Sorry?
I was going to say, I think, sometimes we do come around in cycles, in terms of, because I think it's somewhere that you've been before. So maybe there's another opportunity waiting for you here.
Yes. I mean, I'm going to have to, not that I try, that I think I preach, but if I did preach this, I'd certainly have to start practicing it. And that is what I'm doing. It is what I'm doing. I had a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses came to the door yesterday, and they said, "How are you managing to keep positive in the face of all this, sort of financial crisis that we're going through?" And I said, "Very well, thank you." I think it shook them a bit. And I said, "Do you find that reading the Bible is a comfort to you?" I said, "Yes, I do. I think the Bible is the most incredible book." And they didn't know what to do. It was very amusing.
Now, I remember there was when you were working with people, and I love this, one of the things you sometimes do, people take too much responsibility for others, you ask them to get the horse to lift its foot. Could you tell us a little bit that? Because that tickled me. I thought that was really fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's one of those situations the thing about this is you ask someone to do a task based on what they, the initial conversation you have, and you work out an exercise. You can, instantaneously people will move into what the real issue is that they're dealing with. I might not be able to see it or if you like, put a label on it for a while, but as soon as we can recognize it, then it might be that it's more appropriate or more revealing for them to do something else other than the original task. And that was a situation with this woman who was, I could see she was almost trying to pick up the horse and carry it around the circle, or carry it over an obstacle. So I said to her, I can't remember exactly what it was, but the task was number one, ask the horse to pick its feet up. And she, as I predicted, she got hold of the horse's foot and started pulling, and as if she could lift the horse or force the horse to lift its foot up. I mean, this is a half a ton of muscle and emotion, survival. And you're going to threaten its very survival by taking its balance and flight mechanism away from it. I don't think so. I don't think you're going to succeed in this this strategy. So she had to work with the horse to gain the horse's trust, so that the horse would be willing to yield its foot, so she could lift the foot up. Because she was, the metaphor for her was she took responsibility for what her team were doing. And she felt she had to do it for them. She was these kind of mumsy people that she cared too much. I mean, she wasn't coming necessarily from a place of lack of caring, but she cared too much that people were successful. And she wasn't willing to let go and let them struggle and let them discover a way for themselves that worked. And of course, she was exhausted and she was killing herself. So when you bring this issue down to the simple thing of asking a horse to lift its foot, and you just can't do that, because you can't make a horse do anything. You can't get it to do anything. But you can inspire it to do things. You can engage with it. So just in that little microcosmic moment in the corner of the school, I remember it very well. It was one of those light bulb moments, because not only did she, was it safe for her to explore a different way of being, a different way of doing things, but she got the results inside her. And everything that she was hanging on to inside herself that was driving the behavior that clearly wasn't working, that started to release as well. I've often had people here. I remember one in particular. She was a senior person. She was working for a guy in her organization, and she felt marginalized. She felt that she wasn't being included. She felt undervalued, and she felt that her chances of progression within the organization were being blocked by this bloke that just didn't understand her, her boss. So I suggested that we use the horse as a metaphor for her relationship with her boss. And she was quite happy to do that. And again, she was someone who was also experienced with horses in her own way. And I asked her to perform a leadership task with the horse. It was quite an advanced thing. And she was completely thwarted against her expectations. And she started to see how, I ask people when they get stuck in these patterns, if I remember, I always say things like, does this feel familiar? And they stop and they pause and they go, yeah, this does. This feels just like, when I'm with so-and-so, or it's just, And it's like, well, they're onto it. They're dealing with the thing inside them when they go into this place. But she said, oh, yeah, it's just how I am with whatever his name was. Peter, for the sake of argument. And so we spent the day working this through with the horse until she came into rapport with it and transformed her relationship with the horse right then and there in the paddock. And but she was very pleased about that. I mean, because that was an achievement for her. But 2 weeks later, I got a phone call, and she said, "You'll never believe this," and I don't even believe it myself. And I said, "Well, what's happened?" And she said, "My relationship with Peter is completely transformed. He's changed. He's a different man." Oh, really? Yeah, what's he done? He had brain surgery. And she said, I don't understand it. I mean, he's just completely different. He's a really nice guy. And we're getting on so well. And, he's promoted me. And he's given me a pay rise. I said, oh, that's fantastic. I mean, we should send him over here. No, I'm not going to send him over there. You might turn him back into how he was. And that's it. We think that the relationship problem is with them. It's out there. And God, it feels like it, because they're doing the behavior that we don't like. Yeah. It's so difficult, outside of that, to make the connection that when we change, what we see in the mirror is going to change as well. So the horse steps in to be, to be the one in the mirror. My job is to get out of the way as much as possible and to point things out that are going on. I like to think I understand what's going on, but I know that there's something else going on that I really don't understand. And that's just fine with me. That's just the way I like it to be.
Well, I think that's a challenge with most of us when we're working with people, and I found that in seminars and one-to-ones with people is sometimes I can be sitting there thinking, I'm not sure what's next to do. And it's actually by, again, it's that surrendering up that I need to know. and allowing it more to unfold. And one of the things you have said about the challenge of transformational horsemanship is how can we make the level of honesty that's natural to horses natural to us? I mean, it's absolutely natural to us, so no matter what, to horses, I'm sorry, so no matter what is going on when people or any of us are working with horses, they're only going to keep reflecting back to us what we are actually doing. So it's a wonderful way, and I, you know, was thinking back today to when I worked with Maddie, and it was a long time ago, Paul, I don't remember the details, but I do remember that it being extremely profound for me. I am a person who works a lot of my issues, and the thing that was lovely for me was I got instant feedback whether I was on track or not. And that was kind of a revelation, you know, like, is this clear? Do I really have a clear intention? And, you know, with how I was with Maddie and how she reacted, I just got the immediate feedback. And it's lovely because, you know, sometimes we don't always see it in ourselves immediately. So I thought that that was pretty remarkable. So it is, it's a very lovely way to actually gain greater honesty for ourselves, which is tremendous. And one of the challenges, I think, and one of the things that you kind of point out in the book, in terms of all the work that you've been doing, you said, would a nonviolent, gentler, natural way of gaining trust and respect be welcomed in a fear-driven, ruthlessly competitive world, which is, you know, you have mentioned a few times, we're dealing with times that are very challenging and, you know, especially financially and a lot of fear. And the thing is, yeah, I do think that there is a place for this, and I think that this is a time of change for us to look at how we've been doing things in the world. And I just want to do a couple of quotes here from John Roger, who you and I both work with. He's certainly been somebody who's been very instrumental in the way I view life, and I'm very grateful to having him and his teachings in my life. He says that the root of our emotional addictions is our belief structure, which continually undermines us by telling us two things, that we will be alone or abandoned, and that we will lose control of reality. And that's from the Spiritual Warrior book. And he also says, to receive, we must be active. We receive in direct proportion to our strength of purpose, clarity of vision, steadfast faith, and depth of gratitude. And really, with a lot of the work you're doing, that's really, that last quote really is about what you're doing, isn't it? About
completely. Yes. I mean, the four parameters that he outlines there can easily be translated, and I'm not sort of blowing my trumpet here, but I mean I'm just really fascinated by the synchronicity, because obviously I've been working with John Roger and myself for 1979. How long ago is that? Horribly. Makes me feel incredibly old. It must be nearly 30 years. I'm not surprised that, you know, having been steeped in his wisdom, I'm glad that it's seeping out of my pores in a way that's true for me, you know, because trust, respect, understanding, and energy equate, I suppose, in terms of that particular quote to faith would be the trust thing. Respect is gratitude. Self-respect is gratitude, self-esteem. Understanding is purpose, knowing our purpose. And energy is vision. Our vision gives us energy. It taps us into our unlimited energy. If we have a clear vision, a pure vision, that's, as we were saying before, that's not driven or not contrived by the ego as something that's going to prove itself. I was working with a large multinational or global corporation a while back, and when I was being briefed for the work, I said, well, do you have anything with, you know, your mission statements and all that kind of high-level strategic stuff on it that I can get to grips with? And they said, oh, yeah, and they whipped out this glossy folder, and I read the mission statement, and I kind of thought, oh, dear, when I read it, because it was so revealing about the fundamental motivation of the organization. But somebody, you know, somebody a long time ago needed to prove, and the words were, our mission is to be recognized, as the undisputed global food leader. I thought, oh dear, you know, if their organization is built on that as a mission, then it's unsustainable, you know. And would they have the courage to look at their strategy from that level? Because, you know, this has become the Ten Commandments. It's become the, you know, the Holy Grail of the organization. It's like, you know, would they dare challenge that? Would they dare even look at it and challenge it? Because, you know, they were a multi-billion-pound organization globally, and they were having trouble, and you know, and this was very, very aptly reflected to them by the horses. We had 50 of them. This is the top executive team and the managing director down in a large arena with, I think it was about 7 or 8 horses. And something seemed to spark off with the horses, and they acted out the conflict and the drama and the chaos that these guys were dealing with. Completely unstaged, unforeseen. You know, the last thing in the world I wanted was horses sort of charging around the arena, completely seemingly out of control. It took us about half an hour to sort of calm the horses down. But it was just an incredible reflection in hindsight of what was going on with them and their business and their teamwork, and how they were treating themselves and how they were feeling about themselves and each other. It was really dysfunctional. And it was a mixed blessing. You know, they didn't like having this mirror held up to them. And I say to people, if you don't want to look at the truth, then don't come here, because I'll happily, even unconsciously, I'll tone things down and try and not necessarily appease you, but I won't be, I'm not a brutal kind of person. But horses just do not care. They just do not have that as an agenda item at all. It's just like, so that the feedback is going to be raw. It's going to be direct, and people don't like it necessarily, because it does. It says, yeah, you know, there's something that you really do need to look at here. I think they can get a quick fix.
I think people do want a quick fix, but I think, yes. Well, I think what you've just said is absolutely the truth. Horses don't really care about who you are, how much you earn, what you look like, what your position is, and that's really the beauty of the work that you do with them. It's authentic, and it's about all of us coming back into our hearts and to being authentically who we truly are, not who we have thought that we've become, or all the kind of the things we've picked up all the years and the parts of our personality, but who we truly are. And unfortunately, Paul, we're really out of time, and it's a shame, because this has been a really fascinating chatting to you.
Just getting going.
I know.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Very affirming
today,
for me,
Paul.
As well.
Yes, and for anyone who'd like more information on you, either look at my website on BBS Radio, or you can go to www.horsejoy.com. Thank you, Paul. Right. It was really
Thank
lovely
you.
Having you on today. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.